Aletheia, who joins us after a cytopathology fellowship at MD Anderson.
Hey.
And we have Sue Young. I would say sent an email this morning. She's from Chicago.
Okay. Welcome to all of you. All right. So I'll kick off then. So full disclosure, Matt Cecchini helped me. Well, he did a journal club draft using Claude. I think Henry and Anya, you know about this, for me. And then I use that as a basis of my journal club. And initially I thought, well, I'm going to pick different articles for discussion. But in fact, I ended up picking the same articles for discussion. So Claude knows what, I think Claude picked the articles for discussion. So it's pretty smart. Well, it's not smart, but it's clever. I don't know how you describe something that's just a large language model. But anyway, it was very helpful, and I used it a lot to ask questions when I couldn't understand the paper and the statistics and everything. It's very neoplastic dense, this journal club. There wasn't much in the non-neoplastic way. The first article I'm going to talk about is the differential prevalence and prognostic significance of spread through airspaces according to oncogenic driving mutations in lung adenocarcinoma. But a few years ago, I wasn't even sure I believed in STAS. Now I do. And for those who don't know what STAS is, it's a spread of tumor through airspaces. And it entered the World Health Organization classification in 2015 and has been linked repeatedly to recurrence in stage one lung cancer. In the MSKCC series, they reported 40% recurrence after sublobar resection versus about 16% after lobectomy in STAS-positive T1 adenocarcinoma. So it seems to be a prognostic indicator in that you're going to get recurrence, but it seems to be worse if you don't take out the whole lung. And that makes sense because STAS spreads through the airways, and the thought is that it's still left behind after you do a sublobar resection. So I thought this paper would be interesting, and I was initially very impressed with their findings. So they're looking at oncogenic driver status in STAS. It's only been done in small, largely unadjusted series. So they wanted to look at it here. So this the strengths of this paper were that it was a large single institution, a retrospective study in Korea. So they looked at over 4,000 resected primary non-mucinous lung adenocarcinomas. Then they had a separate survival cohort of over 1,000 patients. And they looked at STAS, which was recorded prospectively as erogenous spread by a single pulmonary pathologist since 2008. So this guy was ahead of the curve. So they had all of this information already, and then they did molecular testing, but they were very, very, they didn't do that much molecular testing, sadly, obviously because this started so long ago, I guess. So they did EGFR in most of the patients, about 90%, ALK in 99%, but that was only in 16 of 16. So these percentages are not real. They are based on much different numbers. So EGFR was done in the majority. ALK was only in 16 of the cases that they did them in. I think what it's actually saying here is the percentage positive. Sorry, that's a bit confusing right now. Yes, so KRAS was positive in 29% of quite a large sample. And then they did ROS only in a very small sample of patients. So really the only things you can talk about here really are EGFR and mostly EGFR. And then EGFR was classified as either E19 del or L85R or other. So they didn't really go into more of the different types of EGFR positivity, but those are the majority, as we know. So they looked at the prognostic value of STAS assessed as a 5-year cumulative incidence of recurrence. compared to the EGFR mutation status in the smaller cohort of over 1,000 patients. They adjusted their statistics for invasive size and LVI. And what they found was, I'll move this along, was that STAS was present in 40% of their patients, so 1,600 out of 4,000 patients. The prevalence rose with larger tumor size, as you can see in this graph, and higher pathologic stage, as you see in this graph here, and this graph. But it was highly influenced by architecture. And I couldn't understand this graph no matter what I did. So I asked ChatGPT to explain it to me. Not ChatGPT, actually, Cloud. And basically, how to read this figure is that it's a dot and bar plot. And the bar isn't a magnitude, it's a gap. So each row is one microscopic feature, so micropapillary pattern at the top. And the two diamond markers on that row are the STAS rate in cases with the feature versus those without, so without and with. So for micropapillary, the two diamonds sit at 10.6% and 74.8%, and the bar spanning them is 64 percentage points long. It's the longest in the panel, which is why it's planted at the top. Rows are sorted by the size of that gap. So the panel is essentially a ranking of which single microscopic feature best separates STAS positive from STAS negative tumors. The color scale just re-encodes the bar length. So lipidic sits right at the bottom because its presence is associated with less STAS. In fact, frequency is in the minus. So it really doesn't occur in lipidic. It shouldn't occur in lipidic as we know. So, and then asana pattern has very little STAS. So it is dominated by the patterns. And as we know, you get more STAS if you have pleural invasion. If there's necrosis, there's usually more STAF, vascular invasion, lymphatic invasion. But the micropapillary pattern is overwhelmingly the driver of STAS. So, the presence of STAS vary markedly by driver. So if it was ROS rearranged, it was 100%, as you see in figure 2A here. But as I mentioned, they only did ALK in 16 patients. And you kind of think they must have been selected for that. Maybe they had a lot of STAS and they thought they would check it. In ROS rearranged tumors, it was 100%. Oh, sorry, I got that wrong. ROS was 16 out of 16, 100%. ALK was rearranged in 80%. So it wasn't that many tumors again, but it was, of the tumors they selected, it was 80%. KRAS was not significantly different. And EGFR mutated. So if you had an EGFR mutation, it was increased. If it was mutated, it was actually less than if it was wild type. So wild type EGFR here was slightly higher than EGFR mutated, and it doesn't look like it would be significant, but it was significant. However, if you take stage one, the differences become more clear, whereas in stage two to four, there was so much STAS that you couldn't actually see a difference, which is what you'd expect in stage two to four. Within EGFR mutated tumors, STAS was less frequent with the L858R mutation than EXA9 deletion. And this, as I said, was most pronounced in stage one. So in stage two to four, 77% had STAS, regardless of genotype. If you looked at the survival, there were 49 in the patients, there were 1,117 patients they looked at with recurrences. However, 112 of those patients disappeared somewhere because they didn't do molecular testing on them. So they're quoting too high a number there. But in those patients, of about a total just over 1,000, they had 49 recurrences, 13 local and 36 distant. And the overall five-year cumulative incidence of recurrence, which I'll show you here in this graph, was 12% for STAS positive versus 2.3% for STAS negative. So this is really the main thrust of this tumor, is that the CIR, cumulative incidence of recurrence, was higher if you had if STAS was present, whereas if you didn't have STAS present, in all your tumors, and then in if you had STAS in all the different molecular tests, and then if you had EGFR mutation status in C, which is here, it didn't make any difference. But if you put STAS and EGFR together in D, all of a sudden you can see there's a difference in the CIR. So the blue line here is EGFR positive and STAS positive, and the recurrence is higher. So that I think is the most important finding in this paper. And in fact, they have this summary up here, which is this graph. Whoops. It shows it up here a bit better because they've labeled it. So it depends on STAS. So if you're positive EGFR and you're STAS positive, then your incidence of recurrence is higher. So that sounds great. However, as I said, this is the largest of such series, and STAS was recorded prospectively. It was all by a single pathologist, so it is consistent, and it maximizes internal consistency. However, there are lots of limitations. So there's no data on blocks per tumor. So part of the size STAS gradient may be detection rather than biology. Because there's only one pathologist, no inter-observer data or reproducibility. They didn't exclude MIA, which is minimal invasive adenocarcinoma. And of course, that will weight it down to cases that might be STAS, that might be EGFR positive, but STAS negative. So they should have excluded that. It probably didn't make a huge difference, but that's something they should have done. They didn't adjust for the surgical anatomic context in which STAS becomes a recurrence, margin clearance, resection extent, lobectomy versus segmental and wedge resection. Although we know that 73% had lobectomy. And then the location, central versus peripheral, wasn't discussed. They censored 19 metachronous lung cancers as second primary. So we don't know if they developed recurrence or not. So this isn't the way to deal with this data, which I found out after reading about statistics about this. So what they should have done, they should have counted those, and they should have done a statistics method called competing. I can't remember what it's called. I'll find it again. There's a different way that you're supposed to study this and not censor it. The next paper describes that statistics method. So this is quite useful if you want to do a study to actually see what mistakes other people have made, so you don't actually make those same mistakes. And it's also very difficult to distinguish a metachronous primary from a recurrence. And obviously very difficult in never smokers with multifocal ground glass nodules, where independent indolent lesions arise in parallel. And a new peripheral lipidic lesion 3 years on can be very ambiguous. And of course, this is the Korean cohort that is 57% never smokers. So those are exactly the patient, the cases that these patients were dealing with. They also talk about the narrowing of driver differences in stage 2 to 4 due to reduced confounding, and said that, well, this just shows that it's important in early stage disease and these differences are real. And in advanced disease, other factors dominate, so the driver stops mattering. which they call reduced confounding. However, this is probably more plausibly due to just too few patients, not a true absence. This study was underpowered at that level because you just don't have enough patients without stats. So in fact, it's underpowered if you're trying to do this. There's also something called the ceiling effect. If 77% of all tumors are stats positive, regardless of driver, that rate is pushed up near the top of the scale. There's not much room left to show a difference, which again is a bit like the underpowered effect. But then the most important thing is that stats is partly a consequence of, sorry, stage is partly a consequence of stats. So it's like the chicken and the egg. So you're describing the stage as being important in stats, but stats is actually driving that stage. So you can't really use that argument. So stage 2 to 4 is not a neutral stratum to check the clean stage 1 result against. It's a stratum where interpretation is corrupted by the decision to stratify. The other problem was the selective and very uneven molecular testing. So only EGFR and ALK were analyzed broadly enough to support the multivariable models. And that, you know, they didn't look for RET, MET, BRAF, or HER2, anything else like that as well, which was a limitation. As I mentioned, some patients disappeared because they didn't test for EGFR and they just disappeared in their survival analysis. And again, this is 59% EGFR mutant, which is very much East Asian pattern. So would this translate to a Western population where EGFR mutations are much less common? Probably unlikely. The other problem I have with all of this is that it brought up some interesting questions. So ALK and ROS rearranged tumors are well documented to be aggressive architectures. So the models adjusted for age, sex, smoking, invasive size, but not for histologic pattern. And if pattern is the strongest correlate of stats, which they showed in the paper, 74% if you've got micropapillary versus 10% if you don't have micropapillary, they should be looking at that. So does stats remain prognostic in EGFR mutant stage 1A after adjusting for the grade or the MP plus solid percentage? If ALK rearranged tumors are micropapillary rich and L858R tumors lipidic and acina rich, so much of the apparent driver effect on stats between the different types of EGFR mutation could be mediated by pattern composition rather than being independent of it. So is this a paper about drivers or a paper about growth pattern wearing molecular label? And do the fusions carry independent prognostic weight or do they act only through the architecture, which hasn't really been answered here? So I think the take home message is that stats prevalence is strongly genotype associated. And I think we know it's near universal in ROS and ALK, and it's lowest in small early tumors in L858R mutations. In stage 1A, the recurrence risk carried by stats was confined to the EGFR mutant subgroup. However, in EGFR mutant tumors, which are mostly lipidic and acinar, stats may simply be flagging the minority with an unsampled micropapillary or solid component. I don't think the findings in stage 2 to 4 hold up because they had too few patients and for the other things I've described. And what we haven't established is stats prognostically inert in wild type disease. We haven't established that, and is any of it independent of architecture? So any questions about that, comments?
Well, that was a deep dive, Margaret. you know, I was just looking through the paper. So somebody asked me to give a, you know, update on the new WHO stuff, and I reached out to Sonia, who said that the definition of stats is saying the same in the new WHO. But when I look at the WHO, they don't really define it. I mean, how many clusters, how far away, how many alveolar spaces, they don't define it either in their paper. So I'm just curious what other people are using. Is anybody following strict criteria for what you call STAS? Is one cluster enough? Do you need two? I'm curious.
You don't have any, just as you're alluding to.
Yeah, I just go by whatever is behind the line of the tumor edge, and whether it's one cluster or multiple.
Okay.
I agree with
All
you.
Right.
There's
so
no good definition.
Same here. Yeah. This diagram shows how they, in this paper, they did define how they define STAS. So here's the outline of the tumor, and then here's a little bit of STAS there. And they called anything that was outside the outline of the tumor within 2,500 micrometers or 1 10 times field, microscopic field, was grade one. And then anything beyond that, they called it grade two. But this is something they've published, hasn't been validated by any other group. That's how they defined it. And I think they described it as single cells or clusters, or solid clusters or micropapillary clusters. So they did do some sort of definition.
Okay. Maybe in the methods they refer to it. I just scanned it while you were talking, so I didn't. But I appreciate that. I'll go back and look at that.
I think they did define it better. They talked about grade one and grade two, and then they had that this diagram in their supplemental.
Okay, got it.
Yeah. I don't think they actually said exactly what they called STAS, but I think CADOTA's definitions are single cells, micropapillary or solid, but then you got to worry about the effect of the knife cutting, and then people say, well, artifact is if it's occurring far away from the tumor, or you've got bits of tumor that look like they've been cut in half, but it's very difficult, I think, to be sure if you don't have some artifact or not. There was a letter to the editor about this publication, which I thought I would include as well. When I first read it, I thought, that sounds reasonable. But I don't think I agree with them either, because they got very excited about this paper. And they said that STAS is not a biologically equivalent event across genotypes. It's intrinsic and early in ALK and ROS1 tumors, but in otherwise indolent EGFR mutant tumors, a marker of passage through an evolutionary bottleneck from a proliferative to a disseminating state. So they proposed STAS-positive EGFR mutant stage 1 as a subset most likely to benefit from adjuvant TKIs. So that's a big leap. They also said that invasive capacity is undoubtedly a prerequisite for STAS, which has not been proven. It might be true, but it's not been proven. And they also said that what people have to do is we have to do single cell RNA sequencing of STAS clusters. Well, you can't do that because you can't dissociate them out of archival FFPE blocks. You'd have to do something like ROI-based transcriptomic profiling or multiplex image beam immunizer and multiplex imaging and analysis, some sort of spatial proteomics or in situ hybridization to do that. So the letter was pretty wrong, but it's at least it's a readable hypothesis generating commentary. Any more comments about that? Okay, if there's nothing else, I will go on to extent of resection for spread through airspace as positive stage 1A1 to 2 non-small cell cancer. So this is again is another STAS paper. And again, I thought this was very good at the start, and then after going through it, I thought, not so impressed. So what they're looking at is ever since non-inferiority trials came out, and said that segmentectomy or wedge is now an accepted alternative to lobectomy for small peripheral stage 1A tumors. A lot of people have been doing less than lobectomies and wedges. So, but nobody knows what the effect is on recurrence because of the presence of stats, because you leave lung parenchyma behind. So what they wanted to answer in this paper was whether STAS positive early stage tumors can be treated safely with sublobar resection. So it was a retrospective single institution cohort from Massachusetts Gen, 445 patients were analyzed, and the tumors were less than 2 centimeters, and they excluded all the correct cases. They used the CADOTA criteria with institutional artifact exclusion rules. They had 5 pulmonary pathologists reviewing independently. So institutional concordance was approximately 80%, which wasn't great. There was no central re-review, no STAS grading, and no morphological subtyping, no distance from the tumor edge. They did hold 2 consensus conferences during the study period. The presence of recurrence was adjudicated at the discretion of the treating thoracic surgeon or medical oncologist with chart review verification. And they used the correct type of statistics method, which is the competing risk models rather than the censorship. It's called the multivariable fine grade competing risk models for recurrence, so competing with death. And lung cancer-related death competing with other cause death. And they adjusted this a priori for invasive tumor size, LVI, and high-grade histology. So they also did an exploratory study where they looked at recurrence-free survival across lobectomy versus segmentectomy versus wedge, and anatomic versus non-anatomic. So anatomic was what they put everything into. So wedge and sublobar resection was all anatomic. That's the name they used. They restricted this to patients with at least 1 Hyla N1 station sampled. And they also looked at the margin to invasive tumor diameter ratio among all sublobar resections, which apparently is the standard now. You don't just look at the margin of resection. You look at the margin to invasive tumor diameter ratio, which apparently is more reliable to say that you're not going to get recurrence. So what do they find? Just diagrams of STAS, images of STAS. They found that they had STAS positive cases in 35%. And had a median follow-up of 48 months. STAS-positive tumors were more often high-grade, larger, more often LVI, which we know. Within the STAS-positive cohort, they had 81 had lobectomy and 77 had sublobar resections, 31 segmentectomy, and 46 had a wedge. Sublobar patients were older with lower FEV1 and DLCO, but their tumors were smaller with equivalent LVI and grade. In the STAS-positive cohort, recurrence was significantly more frequent after sublobar resection, with higher lung cancer-specific mortality. So this propensity matching, but what that does, it cuts down the number of cases you can use in your statistics because they're matching everything, all the patients to the different types of clinical and pathological findings. So when you do that, you only end up with 40 pairs. So they found that, 40 pairs, so one with STAS, one without. So the outcome survival was similar, so nothing different, but the RFS, the recurrence-free survival, was significantly worse after sublobar resection. And in their exploratory analysis, inferior RFS, so they had inferior RFS with wedge resection, but not segmentectomy. So now they find that wedge resection is bad, but not segmentectomy. They also found a difference in the margin to tumor ratio of one or more as well. Right, so the limitations of this study. It was interesting that they didn't get the historical numbers that you've got in the publications. So Kadota and Eguchi reported about 40% of recurrence after sublobar resection. Here it was only 15%. Some of this might be shorter follow-up, but most is presumably better selection and staging. One reader per case with 80% concordance means the exposure variable is misclassified in roughly one in five, which is quite high. They didn't look at extent or distance from the tumor edge or the morphological subtype, which would be the kind of prognostic gradient that some people have used with STAS. They didn't look at any of the possibility of artifactual STAS as well. The HILA N1 sampling, this is something that can't help. In the lobectomy arm was 87% versus 44% in the sublobe arm, because of course you're going to get less nodal sampling in those. The other thing is that they ended up with so few events that the statistics became less significant than they made out. So they got things that looked very significant, but the confidence intervals were very, very high in their statistical results. So would you change an operative plan on the strength of a hazard ratio whose confidence interval spans a 17-fold range? Probably not. The paper asserts a stepwise oncologic benefit with increasing extent of resection. Singles out wedge resection in the title and offers segmentectomy as a reasonable intermediate. However, crude recurrence after segmentectomy is, if anything, marginally higher than after wedge, if you looked at the crude data. And then, of course, you've got the problems with the sublobar arm having older patients who had less good lung function and probably more likely to die of something other than lung cancer. The authors suggested that completion lobectomy might need to be done if you find STAS on the basis of three excluded patients, because in their study, they had three patients they excluded that had completion lobectomy done. So the take-home message, the authors conclude that in STAS-positive low-stage cancer, sublobar resection, especially wedge, is associated with substantially worse recurrence-free survival than lobectomy, and therefore wedge resection should not be performed. However, the entire signal rests on 14 occurrences, and the sublobar arm was staged far less thoroughly, so perhaps STAS marks a tumor needing proper nodal assessment and closer follow-up rather than one that necessarily needs more parenchyma removed. And then this brings us to the discussion point. Should we be doing intraoperative STAS assessment? Any comments about that? And again, this is their main finding here. Comments or remarks?
I still don't think our surgeons are asking us for this. I don't recall an instance when they have, so we don't mention it.
Oh, you don't look at STAS?
Not on Frozen.
Oh, not on Frozen, right. Yeah. I think it must be darn difficult on Frozen. And then there was another correspondence letter to the editor about this. And it brought up all the statistical criticisms that 14 recurrence events cannot support a stable four covariate model, blah, blah. And then they proposed a Firth penalized regression. So I asked Claude, is this true? And Claude said no. So I think I believe Claude. It says that the statistical solution is not correct, but I wouldn't know. That's above my pay grade, that statistics. So. I think Claude's pretty good at statistics. I think I'll believe it. So the next paper is the role of rapid IHC in elevating STAS diagnostic accuracy during intraoperative frozen section for lung adenocarcinoma. Nobody's asking us here yet, thank goodness. So as we know, on frozen section, H&E small clusters of tumor cells within air spaces are easy to miss or confuse. Let me just call this up. Here we are. As you can see in this diagram, frozen section, if you have immunohistochemistry for cytokeratin, you can pick out the cells and you can tell that it's not macrophages. And that's their method. So what they did a rapid cytokeratin immunostain to a frozen H&E. And compared it to frozen H&E. So they didn't do this live during a frozen section assessment. What they did was they got tumors from 153 patients undergoing resection, and then they got the sections cut for frozen section when they came in fresh samples, and then later on pretended that they were doing a frozen section on them. So they got one section cut for H&E staining and one for immunohistochemical staining. And if you see the time to taken to do it, they said that to do the H&E staining is 7 minutes and 23 seconds, which seems a long time to me, whereas the IHC staining was only 12 minutes. So I don't know if anybody agrees with me, but I think that doesn't seem right somehow, that IHC staining would take only 12 minutes and just the H&E would be 14 minutes. And then they also said that the average time to look at the section to look for STAS was 2 minutes 53 seconds, whereas you could find it so quickly with the immunohistochemistry only took 23 seconds on average. So the amount of time that you increased was only about, I think they said, about 6 minutes or so. 7 to 8 minutes, I think, is what they said, which is still quite a lot of time if the surgeon's waiting to hear from you. They used three pathologists of varying experience. They never told us who was the experienced one, who wasn't. And of course, the gold standard was the paraffin sections. So what do they find? They found that the mean sensitivity rose from 73% to 87% using the immunohistochemistry, and specificity from 85% to 89% across all experience levels, and the intra-observer agreement. So what they did, I didn't mention that, they did the study in two ways. They looked at the H&E blinded, then they looked at the immunohistochemistry with the H&E blinded at another time, and then another time they looked at the H&E again, and then another time they looked at the immunohistochemistry and H&E again. So then they looked at the intra-observer agreement between the H&Es and then the H&E plus the immunohistochemistry. So the inter-observer agreement improved as well if you use the immunohistochemistry, but that was only 65% to 77%. They said the average diagnostic time decreased without significantly extending overall frozen section processing, because they could see the STAS so quickly. Residual misdiagnoses were attributed mainly to sparse STAS clusters, macrophage mimics, and artifacts. So they still made mistakes when they had immunohistochemistry. So their take-home message is that you can improve the sensitivity and reproducibility of intraoperative STAS detection at little time costs, which could make intraoperative STAS a more reliable input to the sublobar versus lobar decision. The interobserver gains are real, but were only moderate, and immunohistochemistry does not resolve the fundamental problem that keratin also lights up displaced or artifactual clusters. Also, single-center data warrant multi-center validation. The Inter-Kappa inter-observer cap of 0.67 is only a modest agreement. So I wonder how much of that was with the less experienced readers. So we still don't know the larger question whether intraoperative status should drive resection extent at all. It's not really settled, I think, by any of these papers that we've looked at. So any more, any comments?
Is anyone doing IHC during frozen section?
We're not here, and that's probably not the first use I would find for it, to be honest, because again, our surgeons here don't ask either about status on frozen.
No, I meant in general, is anyone doing leg for the breast lymph nodes or anything? Because they have asked here once. We don't do it at this point, but there was a discussion about it. So I'm just curious what other people do, not only for status.
Yeah, we're not doing it in Arizona. We're not doing it in Arizona, but I would love to. I feel like there's always that one frozen where you're like, if I just had a keratin, it would be so helpful.
Remember, I had a breast resection after adjuvant therapy, and it was so hard to tell the difference between the macrophage clusters and recurrence or, breast cancer that was still present. So difficult. Yeah. But we've only got a few minutes left, so I won't go through this one. This is just talking about another variation of something else that we have to be worried about that seems to happen a lot. This is a new type of tumor, although there hasn't been very many of these recorded yet. So the NUT M family fusion tumors. We know about these, but this is now a particular type of fusion, NFATC2 NUTM2B fusion. It was reported only recently, but they don't really know how it behaves, and they're very rare. They're very cytologically bland, so these are pictures of it here. There's a lot of desmoplasia. Apparently, they have a lot of lymphocytic infiltrate around them, quite well circumscribed. But of course, they're very easily misclassified as adenocarcinoma, sclerosing pneumocytoma, salivary type tumor, or metastasis. So they have a cohort of 6 cases, a median age of 53, incidentally detected peripheral lung nodules. Interestingly, they were all CK56 positive. Now, I never use CK56 anymore. I just rely on P40. So that's interesting. They're P40, P63 negative. Here we go. CK56 positive. Here are the images. GATA3 positive, calponin positive, EMA positive, DOG1 with the perinuclear dot-like pattern, and P63 and P40 negative. That's 8 o'clock. So they're kind of interesting, and they apparently were very indolent, but there's not enough to know if they really truly are indolent. Very close to 8 o'clock. Any comments? Has anybody seen this tumor?
Not that I know of.
There's something, no, me too. I probably missed it. I don't know.
Probably seen and signed out as something else.
Yes.
Yeah, right, exactly.
Although I guess Molecular might be picking it up for us nowadays.
If you do it.
If you do it, exactly. And then there were other papers. One paper I found very useful, I very interesting to read, was the one on pulmonary fungal infections in immunocompetent patients, because we get that quite a lot now. People are in ICU. People coming from outside the country, we get weird and wonderful pulmonary fungal infections. And it was very interesting. It was useful, I think, because it helped you decide how to interpret some of the tests that we do. So I found that paper interesting and useful, that review. Okay. If no more comments or remarks, I'll let you all go.
Thank you, Margaret.
Thank you.
Thank you. Very good. Margaret. Thank you. Thank you.